But you know, I've argued and I've debated online anyway with Bob Nayman about J Street. I tend to be rather cynical about it. He tends to be more optimistic or sort of associative,
guardedly hopeful.
Feels that that's one piece of the puzzle, and you know, that's something we can talk about. This is, you know, this is about strategy and tactics and all that stuff, and that's a big, you know, when you're basically a weak movement, strategy and tactics become even more important.
Well, opinions are those of speakers. I think I might have just said that moments ago, but I'll say it again. Jason and crew, it looks like, are here today. Thanks, David. Thanks for listening, everybody out there. Pledge drive next month, next time we're on the air, I think.
Start saving your money.
Yeah. Payroll deductions are still possible in the spring. That's generally done in the fall, but you're welcome to try that as well. Let's see.
Just not working anymore. They used to call us working class. Hi, everyone, and welcome to the April 16th, 2011 edition of the Illinois World Labor Hour, brought to you over the air by WEFT 90.1 FM Radio in Champaign, Illinois, and webcast worldwide at weft.org. The news and opinions expressed in this hour of programming are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of WEFT's management or board of directors or of Prairie Air Incorporated. Now here's Tom Thomas to acknowledge some of our underwriters.
This hour of programming is being brought to you by you listeners of WEFT and by the Brotherhood of the Maintenance Way. The Brotherhood of the Maintenance Way employees are proud to continue their support for the Illinois World Labor Hour. A democratic union, the BMWE, celebrates the voice for labor on WEFT. It is our hope that all workers may share the same benefits that they enjoy, such as living wages, job security, away-from-home expense pay, early retirement, Canadian-style health insurance, and guaranteed year-round work. And the Illinois World Labor Hour is supported in part by you listeners of WEFT and by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support community radio in East Central Illinois. Jason?
Thanks, Tom. I'm your host, Jason Kozlowski, here today with co-host Tom Thomas. We'll have some workers' interest news for us, and later in the show, the Labor Hour Cultural Corner. Tom's poem for this week, from his book Cries for Justice, is a tribute to the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., entitled Remembering Martin. Also here with us today is original founder and co-host of the Illinois World Labor Hour, Bill Gorell. How you doing today, Bill?
Oh, fine.
Great to hear. And we're going to have an excellent show for you here today, filled with some labor history, some contemporary news, other news and views, and Bill's got a piece, a very interesting piece, from the Republican Party Labor Platform of 1956 that we're going to discuss, and I think would provide an excellent talking point for today.
And now, possibly a message from Jesse Ventura.
Oh, yes, that's right. A must-talk about certainly in the second half of the show. Absolutely. Now here's Tom to kick off this week's edition of Workers' Interest News. Tom?
Champaign County board members meeting last Tuesday deferred action on a proposed intergovernmental agreement with the cities of Urbana and Champaign for the design, construction, and maintenance of the Olympian Drive North Lincoln Avenue project north of Champaign-Urbana. Meeting in a committee study session on Monday, the Urbana City Council okayed the agreement, but county board members voiced numerous concerns about the draft agreement on Tuesday night. They suggested removing a sentence fragment that mentioned Olympian Drive between Cunningham Avenue, which is U.S. 45, and Duncan Road. Several board members noted that the county board had not signed on to construction of Olympian east of Lincoln Avenue. One thing they expressed was concern about which government would be responsible for eminent domain if litigation should be needed to acquire property for the project. The board ultimately voted to defer voting on the Olympian Drive project until next week's full county board meeting, after county attorneys have reviewed the agreement and modified it based on board members' concerns. The voice on the Lincoln Avenue part of the agreement was deferred until next month as well. Jason?
Thanks, Tom. On Monday, April 18th, Service Employees International Local 73, representing service and maintenance workers here at the University of Illinois, will plan to go on strike if contract negotiations with the University of Illinois do not result in a tentative bargaining or tentative agreement before then. They're actually bargaining this morning in a session, and it will be interested to see how that is how it's going to turn out. But it seems as though, in all likelihood, especially based on the unsuccessfulness of bargaining so far, that they'll be going on strike. This is something that is going to receive considerable support from people on campus, including from the GEO, Campus Faculty Association, and other area local unions. And before turning it back over to Tom with some more news stories, I have to say, as someone who has paid attention, like all of us, to local labor relations, and especially in the University of Illinois, I have to say that this has come to this point is just an abject disgrace, just because every single contract in the last several years has either come to the point of or resulted in a strike, and that this is the case, especially for this particular group of workers, many of whom start out making low wages, many of whom are laid off for a long period of time and are in a position of insecurity, is something that I think is particularly horrible and deserves the support of all local union people, and certainly will be receiving my full-throated support come Monday on the picket lines for however long that strike is going to occur. Tom?
Hey, the official who oversees the nation's air traffic systems resigned on Thursday, the day before yesterday, and the Federal Aviation Administration began a top-to-bottom review of the entire system following disclosures of four separate instances of air traffic controllers actually falling asleep on the job. FAA Chief Randy Bobbitt said in a statement that Hank Krakowski, head of the agency's air traffic as organization, has submitted his resignation and that the FAA's chief counsel will temporarily take over for Krakowski while the agency searches for a replacement. Bobbitt had moved on Wednesday to have a second air traffic controller added to more than two dozen airports around the country. The controllers were added just hours after a medical flight was unable to rouse a lone controller working at 2 o'clock a.m. at the Reno Tahoe International Airport. The FAA reported that the Reno controller was out of communication for more than 16 minutes because he was sound asleep. The plane did land safely with assistance from controllers at a regional radar facility in Northern California. Bobbitt said he would be conducting a top-to-bottom review and analysis of the FAA's entire air traffic system. Jason?
Thanks, Tom. From Hibbing, Minnesota, the hometown of Bob Dylan, after months of unsuccessful negotiations, 150 registered nurses at Fairview-owned Range Regional Health Services are voting whether or not to authorize a strike for their nurse leaders. Hospital executives have left us no choice, said April Klander, a registered nurse, chair of Minnesota Nurses Association's bargaining team at RRHS. Our nurses continue to have critical concerns related to staffing levels and the safety of our patients, yet management refuses to adequately address these concerns. We cannot continue in good conscience working in situations and circumstances that continually put our patients and ourselves at risk, end quote. Nurses and hospital executives have been bargaining since September 2010 in an effort to reach a new labor agreement. Results of yesterday's vote, which is being held at an undisclosed location, will be announced sometime today, the union said. We are very disappointed that after 8 months and more than a dozen negotiation sessions, hospital management will not commit to a contract that addresses employee and patient safety, said Klander. Along with staffing levels and patient safety, other sticking points in negotiations include hospital management's demand to force nurses into a paid time off structure that lumps sick days and vacation days together instead of keeping the two separate. Other issues involve management demanding the ability to quickly change or extend a nurse's shift, making it difficult for nurses planning ahead for situations such as daycare services, transportation, or other circumstances. Klander said nurses want contract language that provides for staff nurse input into the delivery of nursing care, RN input regarding staffing levels that includes acuity or how sick patients are, and a safe working environment. Tom?
The nation's unemployment rate dropped to its lowest level in 2 years during the month of March, and the near future outlook is promising as numerous major companies are planning on adding more jobs to their workforces. The increased hiring cut the unemployment rate to 8.8%, way down from what it had been, and a most encouraging sign for the unemployed. The private sector added more than 200,000 jobs for the second straight month last month, and it was the first time that has happened since 2006, more than a year before the recession started. And it could mark a major turning point in jobs creation. A March survey of CEOs indicated that several of America's largest companies are planning on stepping up hiring for at least the next 6 months. Economists expect stronger hiring to endure throughout the year, producing a net gain of some 2.5 million jobs for the year 2011. Even so, that only makes up for a very small portion of the 7.5 million jobs lost during the recession. Jason?
Thanks, Tom. From the story from the New York Times from last week about Japanese nuclear workers, especially those who are working in the facilities that were melting down, these thousands of workers working in dangerous conditions were actually not employees of these particular facilities, but actually these were contractors exposed to dangerous levels of radiation, about 16 times as high as the levels faced by Tokyo Electric employees last year in an incident, according to Japan's Nuclear and Industrial Safety Agency, which regulates the industry. These workers, however, remain vital to efforts to contain the nuclear crisis at the Fukushima nuclear plants. They're emblematic of Japan's two-tiered workforce, with an elite class of highly paid employees at top companies and a subclass of laborers who work for less pay, have less job security, and receive fewer benefits, Such labor practices have both endangered the health of these workers and undermined safety at Japan's 55 nuclear reactors, critics charge. Quote, "This is the hidden world of nuclear power," end quote, said Yuko Fujita, a former physics professor at Keio University in Tokyo and a longtime campaigner for improved labor conditions in the nuclear industry. He said, quote, "Wherever there are hazardous conditions, these laborers are told to go. It is dangerous for them and it is dangerous for nuclear safety," end quote. Of roughly 83,000 workers in Japan's 18 commercial nuclear power plants, 88% were contract workers in the year that ended in March 2010, the nuclear agency said. At the Fukushima Daiichi plant, 89% of the 10,303 workers during that period were contractors. In Japan's nuclear industry, the elite are operators like Tokyo Electric and the manufacturers that build and help and maintain these plants like Toshiba and Hitachi. But under those companies that are contractors, subcontractors, and sub-subcontractors, with wages and benefits and protections against radiation dwindling with each step down the ladder. Interviews with about half a dozen past and current workers at Fukushima Daiichi plant and other plants paint a bleak picture of workers on the nuclear circuit, battling intense heat as they clean off radiation from the reactor's dry wells and spent fuel pools, using mops and rags, clearing way for inspectors, technicians, and Tokyo Electric employees, and working in the cold to fill drums with contaminated waste. Some workers are hired from construction sites, and some are local farmers looking for extra income. Yet others are hired by local gangsters, according to a number of workers who do not want to give their names. They spoke of constant fear of getting fired, trying to hide injuries to avoid trouble for their employers, carrying skin-colored adhesive bandages to cover up cuts and bruises. In the most dangerous places, current and former workers said, radiation levels would be so high that workers would take turns approaching a valve just to open it, turning it for a few seconds before a supervisor with a stopwatch ordered the job to be handed off to the next person. Similar work would be required at the Fukushima Daiichi plant now, where the three reactors in operation at the time of the earthquake shut down automatically, workers say. Harrowing and horrifying stuff. Bill, yeah. You want to get to anything before we get to the cultural corner?
Well, I don't know. Would you like to hear this letter from Jesse Ventura?
Yeah, why don't we go into that?
It's kind of related. It's a performance. It's by our good friend Eric Sizemore, who, besides being a librarian, is a actor and vocal performer and a DJ on a commercial radio station. So are you ready to punch up the auxiliary channel there?
Sure thing.
Okay.
That's up on it right now.
There you go. I hope.
This is Jesse Ventura with a letter to the ruling class. You control our world. You've poisoned the air we breathe, contaminated the water we drink, and copyrighted the food we eat. We fight in your wars, die for your causes, and sacrifice our freedoms to protect you. You've liquidated our savings, destroyed our middle class, and used our tax dollars to bail out your unending greed. We are slaves to your corporations, zombies to your airwaves, servants to your decadence. You've stolen our elections, assassinated our leaders, and abolished our basic rights as human beings. You own our property, shipped away our jobs, and shredded our unions. You've profited off of disaster, destabilized our currencies, and raised our cost of living. You've monopolized our freedom, stripped away our education, and have almost extinguished our flame. We are hit. We are bleeding, but we ain't got time to bleed. We will bring the giants to their knees, and you will witness our revolution. Sincerely, the serfs.
Yes, folks, that was, again, Eric Sizemore imitating Jesse Ventura. Jesse Ventura is a very interesting character, you might say, and definitely character is the word to use. Former Navy SEAL, professional wrestler, TV show host.
State governor.
What was that?
State governor.
State governor, yes, that's true. I thought the reference to the unions was interesting, too, because he's been kind of ambivalent when it comes to unions. There was one point where there was a wrestler, and it wasn't Bret Hart. It was his brother, whose name I can't remember.
Owen.
Owen Hart. Thank you, Jason. And died. They were lowering him down into the ring, you see, and that's a very dangerous situation. In fact, if you've ever heard the famous thing about Van Halen and the M&Ms, the reason they wanted all the brown M&Ms picked out was if they found a brown M&M, they knew that that stage crew was not detailed enough for them to be flying Michael Anthony in above the stage. That's how dangerous this stuff is.
So it was like a test.
Right. Well, anyway, this Owen Hart, he was killed doing that. And after that, Jesse Ventura called for the wrestlers to join the stunt people's division of the Screen Actors Guild. However, as governor of Minnesota, Jesse was not so enamored of the state and public employees unions, which seems to be a big problem all the time. And but it's been really weird. Like I saw him on a talk show several months ago, and he'd been living in Mexico. And I said, "Well, how come you've been living in Mexico?" And he says, "Well, if you want to have a revolution, you need to be around the people who know how to do it." Yeah. And he's got, I can't remember the name. He had a book out recently, I believe, that had something about revolution in the title.
I think you're right. I don't know the name of the title offhand.
And then he's had the his conspiracy theory show, which I don't know. I did have one problem with it because one episode came out and said that global warming was a conspiracy theory. And also just the way they do it is so hokey. It's a reality show. It's sort of like a Survivor. One of the things I hate about Survivor is the end of every episode, and they get together and they have the faux tribal ceremony kind of thing. On the Jesse Ventura show, they would get together and talk about the conspiracy and do their assignments. It was just so fake. I'm glad he came out with this message. He's got a public. That we don't have, that's for sure, and that even a lot of politicians and other very famous people have, and it's good to be hearing this from somebody like Jesse Ventura than hearing the crap that's been coming out of Charlie Sheen's mouth lately.
Oh, my God, talk about just a horrifying caricature of privilege and abuse in this era. It's just hard to find a better example of that than Charlie Sheen.
Well, I mean, and that's a good example of how money doesn't really make anybody,
cultured.
Or somebody who should be running things.
Yeah.
Because he's like a lot of people. He's he won the sperm lottery. He has his father. He came up in his father's footsteps, and that's not to say that Charlie has not done good work in the past. He has, but he might not have been there without Martin. And Martin is, probably one of the great actors of his generation.
I don't think Charlie would have been there at all without Martin.
Well, that's very possible. But Martin is probably one of the great actors of his generation.
Absolutely.
Sure.
Very, very progressive man. He'll go out and get arrested, not for, doing crack in his hotel room and having guns and stuff, but he'll go out and get arrested being on a picket line at a demonstration.
Or at the School of the Americas.
And then you have, that's just what I say. I'm glad to hear, celebrities coming out with these things. We need to hear more of that. Because Jesse Ventura is not like Warren Beatty or Barbara Streisand coming out and saying something leftist. It's kind of harder for the right wing nuts to jump all over Jesse Ventura.
Yeah, in part because I think he covers a lot of different and blurs a lot of different boundaries with some of these things. And in part, I think it's because of some of the positions, especially that when you pinpoint this too, that he has had, less so when he was governor of Minnesota, but at other times espousing some certainly class-oriented issues. And I think this speaks to that, especially in our time, just how fluid some of these things are. That is, it needs to coalesce in much more, a much greater degree in order to articulate a greater, more effective critique of power. But it goes to show just how many different people are taking up this sort of class-oriented language that is increasingly critiquing and putting the finger on wealth and privilege and especially corporate abuses.
Correct. Well, I don't know. Think we've got time for Tom now?
I think we've always got time for Tom and his wonderful poetry. So we're going to get to Tom's poem, which is Remembering Martin this week. Tom, take it away.
On the fourth day of the fourth month of the year 1968, a champion of justice fell, a victim of ignorant hate. He had a dream those years ago he tried to spread throughout the land, a dream of peace and parity for which he chose to speak and stand. He spoke and stood in many towns and marched with sisters and brothers and spread his words of peace and love, inspiring many others. He taught equality was right, while all bigotry is evil. No matter the shade of your skin, each and all of us are equal. Yet for the wisdom that he taught, J. Edgar's sniper shot him down the day he was preparing to march with strikers in Memphis town. He had a dream that marches on 4 long decades after he fell. It's in sight, but we're not there yet, not until in unity we dwell. What it was that Martin died for, each one of us must remember. Stand in solidarity, and our movements they can't dismember. Remembering Martin was written at the Poets Loft in Champaign, Illinois on January 19, 2007, and was brought to you live today, April 16, 2011, here on the Illinois World Labor Hour on WEFT 90.1 FM in Champaign, community radio for East Central Illinois.
That was outstanding, Tom. I think a great choice, not just because of the quality of the poem itself, which you always provide excellent poetry, but also because, fittingly enough, today is the 43rd anniversary of the successful settlement of the Memphis sanitation strike that resulted in a 10% wage increase for sanitation workers, and unfortunately came after some violent incidents there regarding strike activity, but also none more so than the assassination of Martin Luther King April 4th, 1968.
Wow. Yeah, you know, a 10% wage increase, man, that's a pretty incredible victory there.
Yeah, I know. It goes to show, one, just how difficult these things are to attain, especially nowadays, and two, they were severely underpaid. That is, they were brought up significantly, and at the same time, they're severely underpaid and faced an awful lot of problems at work, especially over safety issues, and treated with such disrespect that the main campaign during this was about dignity and uplift as much as over wages, being famous by the I Am a Man placards that they wore so much. So
a lot of health issues too.
Yes, absolutely, on and off the job, no doubt about it.
You know, I don't know if you had anything particular planned for now, but I was just wondering, what did you think of Obama's speech Wednesday?
The speech
about the budget and
well, I'm not very sanguine about all of this. In fact, I think that a lot of this has been tabbed quite well by others, as far as at times talking tough and about a good game, is standing forthright on certain things and then always willing to give ground. I mean, he's posturing himself for the election in 2012, but I don't have the feeling at all that he's not going to be giving ground on a lot of these budgetary issues, especially given that he already did this anyway. So regarding issues with public health care funding and HEAP and all this. So I feel like in many ways this is a lot of posturing, and we're going to see Obama moving even more to the right.
Well, yeah. Do you think it's another case of him starting out negotiating where he wants to end up?
Yeah.
You know, I don't know. I was talking about this with a lawyer, you know, and I always would think lawyers would be people who are really into negotiation and so on. And I'll go ahead and say it's my sister who's a adoption lawyer, actually, and also does, you know, some other family law things. And she just, her attitude about it is that, well, you see, because I was just saying that, you know, if you're going to bargain, if you're going to negotiate, you know, that's like a guy stopped by today. I got an old pickup truck sitting out in my driveway. It's been sitting there for a while. And a guy, I was getting ready to leave, and a guy pulls in, and he says, hey, would you like to sell that truck? And I said, well, I don't know. And I don't even drive it. It's got some things wrong with it. And I just kind of keeping it around in case I have some extra time and money someday and maybe make a little project out of it, you know. And He goes, well, what would you want for it? I just go, $1,000. He's like, oh, well, you know, that's no way. And I said, well, what were you thinking about it? And he's going, oh, I was thinking 125. Well, you know, I mean, I didn't want to sell it that bad, but I sure wasn't going to start out, you know, with $125, you know, and, but it's just, that's, I just, you can't, I don't see how you can bargain if you're going to start out. See, her attitude is, well, that makes him look like a better guy. Well, all it does is make, to me, it makes him look like somebody who doesn't know how to bargain and who isn't delivering, you know, for people.
Milk toasty comes to mind.
Yeah. It just, he's automatically pulled over to where it's like, and it's been like with this budget thing, it's like, oh, they get one thing. Then all of a sudden, then, you know, the Republicans, I mean, they know how to do these things and they've haven't been beaten up that bad politically because they've stood up and bargained. And I think there's a reason for that. Because they show that they can deliver on some things. Now, there's a lot of things that they don't deliver on, you know, which keeps their base, you know, under. They've never delivered. You know, Thomas Franks points this out in What's the Matter with Kansas.
Right.
They'll never deliver on abortion because that's something they can use to keep that constituency riled up. But it's really frustrating. I mean, with the whole healthcare thing and everything else, you know, you just don't start out where you want to be.
Yeah. I mean, and especially jaundiced by how things went in healthcare, where, I mean, the public option was never seriously on the table, as Tom Daschle had admitted, and then was forced to retreat about as he talked about all of this afterwards in order to try to shore up their base and make it seem as though they weren't sold out. I mean, really, for the last 6 months, is it really a surprise that some measure of more tax cuts for the wealthy or stripping out various elements of social spending for working people would not be on the table from Obama? And they really, I think, tried to tuck this away, especially before so much of the fears of a shutdown, the government shutdown, were going to get underway. But I think these things are impossible to ignore. So, yeah, I'm not optimistic about any of this at all. Why don't we get to a song from Ann Feeney, which I think relates to some of the things we're talking about in terms of things we talk about on the show regarding the rejuvenation of working people, institutions, and just the country as a whole. And we'll come back to some labor history and also talk about a couple other things in the second half of the show. So this is Rebuild America off of Ann Feeney's Heartland CD.
I can sing is justice failed for Rodney King. Keep your eyes on the prize and hold on. Watch them beat him on TV, but Simi Valley set them free. Keep your eyes on the prize and hold on. Hold on, hold on. Keep your eyes. My heart with pain, but I must sing the same refrain. Keep your eyes on the prize and hold on. A cry for justice fills the air, but this is no time for despair. Keep your eyes on the prize and hold on. Hold on, hold on. Keep your eyes on the prize and hold on. Got to rebuild America and keep hope alive. We got to rebuild America, keep hope alive. We've got to rebuild America. Eyes on the prize, that dream we are building never dies. You can't murder justice, no, no, no. You won't bury freedom, no, you don't. We can see a future where our children share the earth. You won't take that from us, no, you won't. We got to rebuild America and keep hope alive. We got to rebuild America, keep hope alive. We've got to rebuild America, eyes on the prize. That dream we are building never dies. Our cities are crumbling, our schools are disgraced. This is no time for weapons in space.
home saying, what can I do? Remember that unity starts with you. We've got to rebuild America and keep hope alive. We've got to rebuild America, keep hope alive. We've got to rebuild America, eyes on the prize. That dream we are building never dies. We gotta educate our children, not put them in jail. By whatever means necessary, we must prevail. And if your politicians tell you it's insurmountable, both bums out, brother, hold them accountable. We've got to rebuild America and keep hope alive. We've got to rebuild America, keep hope alive. We've got to rebuild America, eyes on the prize. That dream we are building never dies. Take back our neighborhoods, violence must cease. Sisters and brothers gotta increase the peace. Yeah, sisters and brothers, keep your eyes on the prize, 'cause we're building the dream and the dream never dies. You sing with me? We've got to rebuild America and keep hope alive. We've got to rebuild America, keep hope alive. We've got to rebuild America, eyes on the prize. That dream we are building never dies. Oh, that dream we are building never dies. You know that dream we are building never dies.
That's the great Ann Feeney with Rebuild America, Keep Hope Alive, off of her Heartland CD. We have a couple public service announcements that Tom will start us with.
Through the end of April, Church Street in Urbana will be closed between Busey Avenue and Orchard Street, just north of Carl Foundation Hospital. Traffic will be rerouted around construction. Kohler and Busey Avenues between Church and Park Streets remain permanently closed north of the emergency room. Park Street is now open, but travel may be slow and restricted to one lane. Throughout construction, Carl Foundation Hospital's emergency room and emergency parking can be accessed from University Avenue at Kohler Avenue.
Also, join us for WEF's 10-day spring drive beginning Friday, April 22nd. Your contribution makes a difference in our community when you support the diverse music, news, and views, such as these, that you hear on WEF. Donations can be made online at weft.org or at WEFT, P.O. Box 1223, Champaign, Illinois, 61824. WEFT 90.1 FM is celebrating 30 years this year of diverse radio programming for East Central Illinois and beyond. And a couple quick plugs. Labor's View TV show can be seen from 4 to 5 p.m. on Comcast Channel 6, I believe it is.
Yeah.
I have to guess at that simply because I no longer have Comcast. Unfortunately, can't watch it. It's a great show that co-host Dave Johnson and also listener and co-host for Labor View, Jim Iman, hosts that show. Terrific, with contemporary labor views and also good segments on labor history. And I would also add, it would be great to have him over here sometime in the near future. Whether or not he will come over here, you must tune into Neil Parthen's excellent Not Another Sports Show, which can be heard from 2 to 3 p.m. on WRFU 104.5 and is often podcasted as well. So if you can't tune in live, you can certainly search for him on the web and listen to that show as well.
Oh, I got a related personal note on that. Damian Matthew, former co-host of Not Another Sports Show, who now lives in Ohio and works for the Service Employees International Union. He had a stroke on March 25th.
Oh, no.
Yeah, but I guess he's doing well now.
Well, certainly our thoughts and prayers go out to him. I was not aware of that. I also wasn't aware that he had moved.
First I've heard of it. It's a big surprise.
Well, I didn't hear about it either. His mother sent me a message this week about his mother, really very, very progressive person herself, and very impressed with the family as a whole.
Yeah.
But Damian, he's a great guy. Very, very funny man. Very witty. I love having him for a Facebook friend. And
it's hard to imagine him having a stroke, though. I mean, he's not that old.
Well, you know, it's a lot of things can happen.
Yeah.
But I hadn't seen him on Facebook for a while. I thought maybe he got real busy with his job. But
well, appreciate you pointing that out, Bill. Get well soon, Damien.
Yeah, if you're listening.
I want to cover an important piece of labor history that I think is worth remembering now. We'll talk about afterwards for a bit. That Wednesday, April 20th, will be the 97th anniversary of the Ludlow Massacre, which had occurred on April 20th, 1914, in Ludlow, Colorado. It in many ways served as the culmination of many events within the strike against the Colorado Fuel and Iron Company, the Rockefeller-owned Colorado Fuel and Iron Company, but it also precipitated further and somewhat brief but violent bouts of labor warfare in and around that segment in southeastern Colorado. A fascinating piece of history, I think, worth recounting at least briefly, that it started in September of 1913 over particular issues, wage increases and union recognition, but also over other issues that are worth remembering. The union was seeking the recognition to have an independent check weighman who would be not appointed by the Colorado Fuel and Iron Company in order to more honestly assess the amount of coal that they had mined in a particular day where they felt that they were being cheated. Another was so that they would not be paid in company scrip, which they could only use at Colorado Fuel and Iron owned stores and where the prices were considerably jacked up. And also, I might add on these particular issues that these were important in their own right, but also happened to be on the books for well over 10 years in Colorado already. So what they were looking for was a recognition, essentially, not just of basic rights and union rights, but of key elements of the law that should have already been enforced, but that the Colorado Fuel and Iron Company simply routinely ignored. These had precipitated a strike in this largely company-owned town so that, like so many places when they went out on strike, they were out of town. So they established a tent colony outside of town that they maintained, a considerable amount of solidarity across broad racial and ethnic lines, received a considerable amount of support from the women and the children there, and also received, typical of the times, an awful lot of violent repression from mine guards and also from Baldwin Felt's agents. Baldwin Felt's agents, made famous in the film of Matewan, were prominent here, and they were similar to the Rockefeller or to the Pinkertons, but in some ways were much nastier.
Yeah, what's interesting about these detective agents, we think of them as detective agencies now, especially right. Pinkertons, and security guards, say at rock concerts or something.
I wonder if Hitler called his SS detective agency.
But they're really, a lot of their major early business was union busting.
Oh, big time.
And security during strikes.
Yeah, absolutely. Bill's absolutely right on this. And they played a prominent role in this. And there was violence really on both sides.
The gun thugs.
They were absolutely
call them down
gun
south.
Thugs. Absolutely, unquestionably so. And this had gone on for months, a strike and violence on both sides, but especially against miners and especially their families who were targeted, till the National Guard had come in and was serving in the area. But as many National Guard units were pulled out, the ones that remained were largely staffed with company mine guards. And so this fight that had broken out, this gunfight that had broken out on April 20th of 1914, which was in all likelihood precipitated by these guards, were shooting down in this valley at the miners and their families, broke out in a violent dispute. And after the ammunition ran out for the miners by the early evening, the guards came in and proceeded to set fire to tents, in addition to shooting Luis Ticas, who was an organizer out in the woods, and killed many in this battle, over 20, but 14 of whom were women and children who were discovered later in a tent that had been burned and their charred bodies discovered. And it's important to note with this incident, all of which is horrifying, that the manner in which they died had everything to do with the behavior of the Baldwin Felt agents who were there beforehand, because what they did was mount these open-air vehicles with what was called the Death Special, which was a machine gun that they would come riding into town often at night, shooting up the tents and these striking miners' communities. And so where these bodies were discovered was in a pit underneath the ground level of the tent, where they dug out a couple feet under so that when the Death Special would come rolling through, they could duck underneath the surface of the ground and escape the bullet fire. So that's where they were hiding during all of this gunfight, when they came in and died from asphyxiation in others just from fire. This had led to public outrage, certainly among miners there who had taken up arms and were persuading other soldiers not to join in to this fight in order to try to quell it. It led to some good things, such as the 8-hour day push and also for some regulatory legislation. On the other hand, it also led to some things like Rockefeller companies enacting welfare capitalist programs and employee representation programs as sham union institutions. So in some ways, the legacy after this led to some improvements, but by and large led to some other things that only continued the sort of repression that businesses were enacting on workers anyway.
Well, there's another strange aspect of this, you might say the legacy of it, and that is in the public relations industry.
Exactly.
Which at that time was a nascent industry, and what had happened was after the Ludlow Massacre, Rockefeller was extremely unpopular in the United States. There were many, many demonstrations against him. He was burned in effigy in probably every major city and large town in this country. People were having demonstrations when he went at his church, when he'd go to church on Sunday. And a pioneer of public relations, Ivy Ledbetter Lee, his name, was hired by Rockefeller to help burnish Rockefeller's image and get him back in the good graces with the public. And basically, there's a at least at the time when I took public relations in graduate school, there was a book called Effective Public Relations, which I would think is probably the standard public relations textbook. And it didn't talk about the Ludlow Massacre. What it talked about was, it's vaguely mentioned, a labor dispute in Colorado. And it was years later that I found out what that labor dispute was really about and why Rockefeller was so unpopular. And Ivy Lee is considered one of the fathers of modern public relations. And this is his feat in rehabilitating Rockefeller's reputation within a year of this incident is considered one of the great feats of early public relations. And Ivy Lee went on to get women to smoke cigarettes in a huge suffrage march in Washington, D.C. in the 20s so that women felt like they could smoke cigarettes in public, and many other wonderful public relations. God, public relations is the worst industry on this planet. I mean, the pollution of our cultural, mental, social environment by these people is what enables the vast pollutions of our many other environments that cause so much harm.
Yeah, no question about it. And well said, Bill. And he was along there with people like Edward Bernays, who were psychologists and people who employed these tactics for...
Well, Edward Bernays is somehow a double nephew of Sigmund Freud.
Right, and took this sort of training in psychology in order to employ these mass persuasion techniques in the 20s for exactly the things that Bill is talking about in order to make smoking popular, which really even until then was seen as a masculine activity and something men ought to do, and it was in order to popularize this and make money essentially off of killing people slowly with cancer.
Well, I don't know who started this, but actually one of the reasons cigarettes, pre-rolled cigarettes, became very popular was that they were put in the rations for the soldiers in World War One. But you have to remember, too, 1914 was just a little bit before World War One when Wilson had the Creel Commission.
That's right.
That was where modern public relations basically came from. There's Lee and Bernays and others on this Creel Commission went on to create the field of public relations. And Hitler said, I believe he might have wrote this in Mein Kampf. I'm not sure, but he's quoted as saying that if he had as good a propaganda as the Allies did, or if Germany would have had as good a propaganda as the Allies did, they would have won World War One.
I don't remember if it was in Mein Kampf either, but I know that that was something he had absolutely reflected on with a degree of admiration of America's superior public relations and burgeoning system at that time. Yeah, fascinating stuff. And really, I think it shows just, I think, the ways in which this sort of history and labor history intersects with an awful lot of other things. And I think it's worth reminding, too, and we talk about this frequently on the show, of just how formative and influential incidents in labor are. And don't forget, people, as we talk about time and time again, that whether or not it's talked about in public history textbooks, whether or not it's talked about on TV, whether or not it's talked about in mass media, that your history is bathed in blood through all of these different labor disputes, and not just simply those within your occupation, and not just with those you might be familiar with, but women and children as well.
A lot of them aren't even taught to school kids.
What's that?
A lot of this history isn't even taught to school kids, like in elementary or even junior high.
By the way, if you enjoy free speech, thank a Wobbly. I'd like to move on here up to the 1950s with another strange kind of document here. And this is the 1956, actually, and I'll date myself, the year of my birth, the 1956 Republican Party platform. And this is would be the platform that Eisenhower ran on for his second term. And this is the labor section of the platform.
And yes, there was a labor section.
Yeah, people actually had parties actually had labor sections, because it was a very important thing at that time. Not like labor is not important now, but it's not treated that way. Anyway, this is all quotation here. Under the Republican administration, as our country has prospered, so have its people. This is as it should be, for as President Eisenhower said, labor is the United States, the men and women who with their minds, their hearts and hands create the wealth that is shared in this country. They are America. The Eisenhower administration has brought to our people the highest employment, the highest wages, and the highest standard of living ever enjoyed by any nation. Today, there are nearly 67 million men and women at work in the United States, 4 million more than in 1952. Wages have increased substantially over the past 3.5 years, but more important, the American wage earner today can buy more than ever before for himself and his family, because his paycheck has not been eaten away by rising taxes and soaring prices. The record of performance of the Republican administration on behalf of our working men and women goes still further. The federal minimum wage has been raised for more than 2 million workers. Social Security has been extended to an additional 10 million workers, and the benefits raised for 6.5 million. The protection of unemployment insurance has been brought to 4 million additional workers. There have been increased workmen's compensation benefits for longshoremen and harbor workers, increased retirement benefits for railroad employees, and wage increases, and improved welfare and pension plans for federal employees. Unquote. Can you believe this in today's climate? This is a Republican document, the platform for their presidential run in 1956.
It is over a half century old, though. Yeah.
Bill, we're going to go back to it.
Where did you get this from? Can you trust everything you get off the internet, Bill? Is this from Mars or something?
Well, I've seen several different iterations of this.
I tease.
Yes. No, it's from the 1950s, which is similar to Mars today. Okay, now back to it. Get this. In addition, the Eisenhower administration has enforced more vigorously and effectively than ever before the laws which protect the working standards of our people. Workers have benefited by the progress which has been made in carrying out the programs and principles set forth in the 1952 Republican platform. All workers have gained, and unions have grown in strength and responsibility and have increased their membership by 2 million. Yes, folks, Republicans were bragging about that in 1956. Back to the document. Furthermore, the process of free collective bargaining has been strengthened by the insistence of this administration that labor and management settle their differences at the bargaining table without the intervention of the government. This policy has brought to our country an unprecedented period of labor-management peace and understanding. We applaud the effective, unhindered collective bargaining which brought to an early end the 1956 steel strike, in contrast to the 6 months' upheaval
presidential seizure of the steel industry, and ultimate Supreme Court intervention under the last Democrat. Oh, they're using that.
Yeah,
even
that
back
started.
Then.
That was a Strom Thurmond thing in the 40s that they took up the mantle of.
Democrat administration. A little slap there at Truman. The Eisenhower administration will continue to fight for dynamic and progressive programs, which, among other things, will stimulate improved job safety of our workers through assistance to the states, employees, and employers. Continue and further perfect its programs of assistance to the millions of workers with special employment problems, such as older workers, handicapped workers, members of minority groups, and migratory workers. Strengthen and improve the Federal State Employment Service. And what the hell is that? I haven't even heard of that. Maybe it doesn't exist anymore. And improve the effectiveness of the unemployment insurance system. Protect by law the assets of employee welfare and benefit plans so that workers who are the beneficiaries can be assured of their rightful benefits. Assure equal pay for equal work regardless of sex. Take that, Phyllis Schlafly.
Yeah, still haven't achieved it. 77% on the dollar as it stands now.
Yeah, she was so much against the Equal Rights Amendment.
Yep.
And so was my mother, just Republican woman. Clarify and strengthen the 8-hour laws for the benefits of workers who are subject to federal wage standards on federal and federally assisted construction, and maintain and continue the vigorous administration of the federal prevailing minimum wage law for the public supply contracts. Extend the protection of the federal minimum wage laws to as many more workers as possible and practicable. Continue to fight for the elimination of discrimination in employment because of race, creed, color, national origin, ancestry, or sex. Provide assistance to improve the economic conditions of areas faced with persistent and substantial unemployment. Revise and improve the Taft-Hartley Act so as to protect more effectively the rights of labor unions, management, the individual worker, and the public. Protection of that, I'm not so big on the Taft-Hartley Act, but maybe...
No, Taft-Hartley is not exactly a standard bearer around here.
Even though my pension's called a Taft-Hartley pension, it did set it up so we had these pensions in the building trades. But it says to improve it,
right.
You know, so, maybe... what I think happened here was if you do read the 1952 platform, it's more like reading the 2008 Republican platform, probably. Even if there is a labor section in that at all. Maybe we'll have it next week if there is one.
I think so. It would be an interesting counterpose, I'm sure, a bookend to all of this, which is just really fascinating. I'm so glad you brought this in, Bill. I'd seen earlier that you did, and I absolutely applauded seconded this.
But I think it was Eisenhower was a real moderating influence on the Republican Party. And, in fact, one of the things that I was looking at also was his message in 1952 is a special message to Congress telling Congress that it would be ridiculous and be dangerous to cut the corporate income tax rate from 52% to 47%.
Yes, seriously. I mean, when you look at that issue before getting to this other issue, especially in the social context of how all of this is situated, absolutely. I mean, it did so much during this period, such as force greater degrees of investment in the United States and some degrees of social responsibility, and also